Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I am Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Got kind of a double header today. Yeah, my old buddy Sam Cedar from the Majority Report is going to be here. Back in the day, we had a show, a streaming internet show before anyone streamed the internet. Way ahead of the curve. But he's the host of the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. Airs live Monday through Friday at noon Eastern on Majority.fm. It's also available as a podcast. Sam Cedar will be here shortly. It's always nice to see Sam in a difficult way. It's difficult and nice to see Sam. There's usually some tension, but I don't think it's there as much anymore. I think we're both older and maybe a little more humbled by the great wheel. The great wheel of time and life, humbled by the wheel. Can you dig it? My second guest today is Bassem Youssef. If you're not familiar with that name, Bassem Youssef is, he was a surgeon in Egypt who started doing a YouTube show, and he eventually became the most popular television personality in Egypt, doing what people called the Egyptian Daily Show. Eventually, he had to flee the country for speaking out against the government. Yep, that's what that happened, and now he's here in L.A. going on auditions. Life of a rebel is tough. It's tough. Doesn't get easier. So, what else? Los Angeles, folks, people here. If you want to hear me and Brendan talk about Waiting for the Punch and other inside stuff about the podcast, this is your one chance. We're going to be at the Ann and Jerry Moss Theater at the Herb Alpert Educational Village in Santa Monica on Sunday, October 29th at 7 p.m., one night only, Los Angeles. Go to livetalksla.org to get tickets or go to the tour page of WTFpod.com. You can get a ticket and a book for a bundle price, or just get a ticket and bring the copy of the book you already have. We'll talk, we'll answer questions, we'll sign all your stuff, and we'll hang out. That's Sunday, October 29th. Go to livetalksla.org or WTFpod.com. Can you dig it? I don't know why that, you know, why am I doing that? Why am I doing that old bit from the movie The Warriors? There's no plan to it. There's no agenda to it. Why am I giddy? Terrified and giddy. I do have a couple emails I'll read. We got a pretty good loaded show. I don't need to ramble too long. I need to drive this into a ditch or spiral down the hole of self and drag you guys with me. I hope you're holding up all right. I don't know. Either things are going to change in the midterms, or we've all got to start learning how to love Jesus. All right, two emails. I'll read them to you. Subject line, your balls. How am I not going to open that up? How am I not going to pop that open? I'm a 49-year-old widow. I'm training for my second half marathon in Brooklyn, New York. Of course, I listen to What the Fuck while I run, because why not? I think things which come out of your mouth. I vibe with what you have to say as well as your interviews until today. In the middle of a 6-mile run, in the middle of a very orthodox neighborhood, I listened to your intro to the Tom Colicchio interview. The story of you getting attacked by your cat Big Head because you were naked was hilarious. Laughed so hard and loudly. I truly wish there was a way that my Hasidic brothers knew that I was laughing at your exposed balls when they're not even supposed to make eye contact with me. Thank you for always making my run significantly more enjoyable. By the way, I included the part being a widow in case any of your male listeners want to date me. Lock the gates, Karen. I'm not going to tell my male listeners. All right, Karen, if they can get you on, if they can find you on the information that I have shared, then maybe either they're truly in love, they're maybe desperate, or they might be quite frightening. Maybe all of the above. Here's another email. Subject line, Satan. Hello, Mark, Brendan, WTF people. My name is Peyton. I'm a 24-year-old musician based out of Florence, Alabama, Muscle Shoals. I love your podcast and keep up with everything you do because I identify with you on some deep level, and I love comedy, interviews with people I do and don't know about, and music, all of which you seem to enjoy too. Anyways, I'm listening to the newest episode now, and I just heard what you said about Trump being Satan and the evangelicals making a deal with him. I think you're absolutely right about that. I'm a Christian myself. I don't really consider myself an evangelical because there are some very negative things that go along with that, but I do consider myself a believer in Jesus Christ. That being said, I think old Donnie is a good example of the Dark Lord, if I've ever seen one. I just wanted to reassure you that not all of us Jesus people support this fool that has somehow become our leader. I believe in you, and I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. I'll continue to support you as long as possible. Keep it up, man. Peyton. Thank you, Peyton. Glad to hear from a Jesus believer who sees Satan the way I do. Obviously, I'm not a full-on Satan guy. Obviously, we're talking about comic book land, the sort of illustrated metaphysical, the mythological metaphysical, the ornate and elaborate metaphysical. One version of it, but it is compelling. It is compelling. Making monsters is compelling. Identifying monsters is compelling and satisfying. Having them reveal themselves to be honest to God fucking monsters, satisfying and terrifying. Fact is, a lot of monsters out. A lot of fucking monsters out. So, Sam Cedar, what I already told you a bit about Sammy. The part where we're airing today is all about how to deal with the news every day in this climate. And since Sam does political news every day, he was out in L.A. and it was a good idea to have him back on. And he's a true friend. And I find him very entertaining, even when he's not being intentionally entertaining. This is me and Sam.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Cedar. Is that too loud? You good?
No, that's pretty good.
You know how to do it.
Yeah, I have this exact same distro box.
You do?
Yeah.
Is that what you call it, a distro box?
Well, a distribution.
Oh, I call it a, I thought it was like a just
headphone box.
Headphone mixer or something. That's fine. Distro box.
Well, I don't know if it's called that. I may have made it up.
So, Sam, what are you doing in Los Angeles?
I'm actually out here for a surprise birthday party for a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And is that, did it happen yet?
No. I guess he's not live, so he's not going to, he's going to find out tonight.
I'm sure he doesn't.
Charlie Fisher.
Oh, Charlie Fisher?
Yeah.
He's turning 53?
No, 50.
50.
Yeah.
How old are you now?
I'm just 50.
You're just 50?
Yeah.
Really?
I'm a little younger than when you. Is that not apparent?
When did you turn 50?
Last year.
Oh, how do you feel?
Old?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, let's get some of the...
I had one of the best softball games of my life the other day, though.
You didn't hurt yourself?
No, I haven't been able to play for 2 weeks.
I talked to another friend of mine, my old friend Lance, and he keeps injuring himself at softball, and I'm like, maybe it's over.
I can't even walk anymore.
Maybe it's over.
I was done in by my own success.
I
had like two home runs, and now I can't walk anymore because I had to run around the bases.
But you're a hero to many.
I had my day.
Yeah.
And I haven't been able to come back.
Who do you play with?
Just guys in Brooklyn.
Oh, in Brooklyn?
Yeah, Prospect Park.
So wait, so you got the place in Brooklyn, and you got the farm, the farm up there.
Yeah, more or less.
And you go up there on weekends.
Yeah, less, you know, not as much as we used to.
And how the children? How's Saul and
Mila?
Mila.
Mila's 11, but I mean, you know, going on 16, which is classic.
Do you speak to her?
She, she will. Complained to me when I cut off her access, her data.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's at 11?
Oh, dude.
What?
It's such a nightmare.
What did you let them do?
Well, you know, she walks 20 minutes to school.
Right.
And so gave her a phone. Should have been a flip phone.
Yeah.
And...
But you can't do that, right? Because she'll get there and the other kids will have the other phone and then you're...
It's a different world. I mean, you know, she spends a lot of time on it, but she still does her homework. And, you know, I don't know. My parents told me don't watch so much TV. And just about every dollar I've made was a function... Just about everything I've done is in some way related to TV.
Right.
So I'm not going to...
So you think you're creating a tech genius? Was that the logic? That, like, let her on the phone?
No, I'm just saying, like, you know, I if she does what she's supposed to do,
yeah,
then
it's okay.
If you know, it's a social thing.
But but it's just texting usually, and like what, Snapchat or whatever.
Snapchat, Instagram. I don't know.
You don't know
all those. Well, I do know.
I think she tried to follow me on Instagram.
Yeah, she may have.
Yeah, I didn't do it.
Well, she probably decided, like, what's the point?
Yeah, well, I don't barely use
it. She wasn't that impressed.
I mean, there was nothing impressive about it. But,
she listened to a couple of your podcasts and was like, man, I'm going to listen to Joe Rogan.
Are you still doing one?
Yeah, I still, every day, actually. In fact, even from out here, I called into my own show today.
Do you have a co-host that works with you?
Yeah. I mean, he fills in for me, once a week, more or less. And, I do like a free half and then a member half, and the member half tends to be funnier. And he's very funny. I mean, he's also very knowledgeable about politics, but he's also very funny. Michael Brooks.
I have to assume that, that now is like now that there's seemingly almost no way out of the shit we're in now, that this must be just incredibly rich for you.
It's actually there's a lot more people listening.
Yeah.
And it's activated a lot of people, but it was honestly the last thing. Well, aside from obviously for the country.
Yeah.
It's not what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, to go back to where we were, you know.
In 1968?
Well, no, but I mean, I'm talking about professionally speaking in terms of the show, to where it's just like talking about how bad Donald Trump is.
And the Republicans and the conspiracies and the, you know, the lying.
I mean, and I don't even go through that so much. It's just like the left is different than it was 15 years ago.
In a better way or worse?
In a better way. In most ways better. In some ways, you know, not so great.
Yeah.
But, like, there was a lot of ideas that were starting to develop. And they're still going on now.
Yeah.
It's just that they're, you know, the debate about, a UBI, which is a universal basic income, versus a job guarantee is sort of been sidelined a little bit. It still exists, but that's not what...
There's bigger problems.
Yeah. But I was gearing up prior to the election for like, okay, there's going to be a huge antitrust push and no monopolies, you know, we're going to attack monopolies. And this is going to be another fight between sort of like the center left and the left.
Yeah.
And...
Now it's just a fight for the actual democracy.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that it's still going on.
Yeah.
And it's just, in some ways just as intense.
Yeah.
And it's a fight for, and part of it intersects with like, should you be talking, you know, this the Russia stuff or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's It's interesting, but it's also just very difficult to sort of navigate from my perspective, because I don't...
You mean the arguments within the left as to what to prioritize?
That's what I wanted to talk about.
Right. Yeah.
But now it's sort of like, oh, I'm going to ignore the fact that, like, oh, the head of the FBI says just got fired because he's been investigating. Yeah. Well, I don't think I can avoid talking about that. That would be weird. That would be weird.
Do yeah, that's a politics a smoke show. Screen. That's
yeah,
a
smoke right. screen. Don't get distracted
we have
by
to,
the fact that yeah. the president's under investigation. Or don't get distracted by the fact that, like, he's going to NATO and literally acting like a child. Like a toddler.
I didn't watch that video where he pushed some guy aside.
Yeah, he pushed. Well, there's two elements to it.
Yeah.
One is he's so... everybody knows this.
Yeah.
He's insane.
Yeah.
But he pushed aside the, I think it's the prime minister of Montenegro.
Right, yeah.
Like, shoved him out of the way.
He's a new guy. Shoved the new guy out of the way.
It, so that he could be out in front of the group that is there. And it's funny just from like a interpersonal thing. Like, the prime minister of Montenegro sort of like turned and thought like it was like a joke.
Yeah.
And he tried to put his arm around him. He realized, like, oh my God,
he's running.
This guy's
gunning for the front.
But then there's also this other, like, sort of the next level is, and I don't know if I buy into this because I just don't think that Trump has this level of situational awareness, that this prime minister of Montenegro was supposedly the, I believe it's something to the effect of, a target of a coup that was supposedly orchestrated by Putin.
Yeah, and he fought Putin.
And right. And so I don't know if Donald Trump is like, I'm going to shove him out of the way. Like,
well, that's the weird thing is that, like, both on the left and, you know, the right have their own sort of, you know, conspiratorial analysis of things. And he puts out so much information, so much contradictory information, so much insanity that, like, there's enough there for you to connect dots that may not be there. But it's sort of like, oh, it's like.
And this is a normal tendency. I mean, I think you know this, your dad. And I had a little bit of this with my dad a little bit, and I don't. Where you try and rationalize stuff that is just not necessarily rational,
right?
And but you, as a not a crazy person, just try and put it in some type of order. Like,
right.
There has to be some reason why this is happening.
Yeah,
and it's possible that it's just. There is no reason why it's happening. It's just that the guy, you know, it's untreated syphilis.
Yeah.
And who knows? Which has actually been a...
Is that one of them you're going around?
There was a piece by a doctor in the New Republic.
Really?
Yeah, a guy named Beutler, who was a journalist father, who just said, basically the piece is like, and this was like in January.
Yeah.
Like, listen, I'm not a partisan. It's very important that his doctor check him for syphilis, because it can apparently go away and lie dormant for like 20 years and then come back and give you some type of
make
like
you nuts.
Neuropathy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's his theory.
But you were saying that, like, you talk to your child like you would talk to Trump, like you would...
the Montenegro thing, like, you see, like, when I go and drop Saul off at preschool, like, you see them, like, okay, it's lineup time, and you see them shove each other and do that exact same thing. You just say, like, Saul, it's okay, you can be number three. You know, you don't.
How does he take it?
I mean, pretty well for, you know, for like a 3 or 4 year old.
Yeah. But like on a day to day basis, like, you're in it, and like, you know, I you know, to my exhausted. Fault. Have was pretty detached throughout the Obama years, and, you know, kind of like doing what, you know, one of the
reasons. I'm fascinated by how you still are sort of like defensive and are project on some measure of judgment onto me, the world, that you're not doing enough in terms of politics.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I still do. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by that.
Why?
I just find it fascinating.
Yeah, because it was not really my forte to begin with, but like I still feel guilty every day.
Yeah, I'm impressed by that.
Yeah, it's gotten harder because I don't think I was ever very good at talking about it. I think, you know, that I came into it as a novice and not very savvy, and I reacted. I'm a good reactor. And if you load me up, I can, you know, I can certainly, you know, be compelling. But I didn't, I feel like you're better at it. I think Rachel's better at it. There's plenty, Chris, hey, there are plenty of people who are better at it and more knowledgeable than me.
Yeah.
And like, and I get, I immediately get to a tone that is completely repelling to almost everybody. So that's one of the reasons. That was one of the big decisions. So now I just sit in a certain amount of, you know, kind of terrified paralysis.
Well, I mean, I think everybody is.
Yeah.
It's people are, my sense is that there are people who are sort of like taking a step back now, and they're not as the same level of intensity.
Brendan literally had to draw a line at some point because I was like texting him and like needing explanation for everything. He's like, hey, man, everyone's going through this. I can't.
Oh, I hear from people. I get texted a lot from people who like, I don't even think knew 6 months ago that I did a daily political talk show for 10 years. And now like I get like literally like a text every half an hour.
What's going to happen
now? Yeah. Or just like, did you see this latest?
Yeah.
I mean, now like I have, I mean, what's weird is that when we were on Air America,
yeah,
I would go to parties.
Yeah.
Not many, but like a dinner party or something. And I would know so much more about what was going on politically than everybody at that table,
yeah,
like to the point where it was just, it was
like,
weird.
Like what
I
are
was
you guys doing?
Now, it feels like
everyone's on
everyone alert. Is like completely as immersed. And
that's a good thing.
I think that's a good thing. You know, I think some people, I would prefer that people are more interested in stuff that is like the politics versus the intrigue.
But yeah, and also versus sort of like damage control. Like, what do we do to fix it as opposed to like, you know, what ideas need to
move
forward?
I mean, damage
forward.
And control is important, but there's a big fight right now on the left is like, how do you fight Donald Trump? Do you fight Donald Trump by saying that he's a horrible human being and that he's bringing about a fascist America? Or do you also need to sort of say like, hey, here's a different vision for what America can be.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in terms of like,
right,
single payer healthcare.
Where do you stand?
I mean, I think both are effective from an electoral standpoint.
Yeah.
And it depends on who the constituency is. But it's a hard thing to not slide into one or the other.
What do you do? Like, do you know how, you're 50, but you have two kids, so it's different than me. Do you know how to, do you enjoy things?
No, I don't. I think I was starting to look forward to that. Like, I wanted to branch out.
Yeah.
But the whole Trump thing literally has made my life so narrow now that I'm constantly updating because I feel like I take my job very seriously.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've got to know about what's going on.
Right.
And so much of it is stuff that I'm not terribly keyed into. But like, you know, to read now about what's going on with the FCC, like with Sinclair Media,
right?
You know, stuff that is like, nobody hearing this knows what I'm talking about.
I do, because like I have been keeping up more than like I do have. I still have the weird, like I can get in back into the narrative pretty easily from being at Air America at the beginning for so long. Like, and I know like I can keep these different trajectories sort of going. So I know the impact of that and how horrible it could be. But like then I don't know where to go with that other than just paralysis and terror. So like for me, what's happening is like
you have no outlet for it.
Well, I mean, I could, but what am I going to say? Like,
but no, you don't have an outlet.
Here's another reason.
I don't think you'd want to do this show.
No, I don't.
Of course not.
I don't.
And frankly, neither would your audience.
No, but also there's the fact that like I don't have any answers. What am I going to tell people to do? Make some phone calls. Maybe write a senator. You know what? You know, like I mean, other than be aware, what do you do?
Well, I mean, awareness is important. And I mean, you can go and sort of get activated. There's a lot of like grassroots stuff that's developing now. But there's no silver bullet. I mean,
no, there's not.
You know,
you need a lot of them. You need like a full magazine.
If somebody has a hotline to the guy who gives out heart attacks.
But do you like, because I'm finding that with me, like I really feel an urgency to all of a sudden like you know enjoy things. Which is no way to enjoy things, with a sort of desperation, a panic.
I feel like I'm drinking more, and like I'm just coming back to the place where I say to my kids, like, no, you can't have candy for breakfast. You know, because at first you're just like, whatever, just eat whatever you want.
In the first few months of his presidency, you're like, just like, where do you want to? You want to go out by yourself? How old are you?
Go
six?
Ahead. Go ahead. Right,
you'll be all right.
Go. Just. Do you remember where we live? We do more comedy now.
Yeah.
On the show.
Do you have funny people come on?
On Fridays, like, I have Kindler come on to rail on stuff, and Judy Gold sometimes comes on, and comedians come on. I've asked you. You have not responded to my text.
I didn't.
No, I don't think so.
I think I did. I've been busy. The summer more. I'll come on Friday. You're pulling the offer?
Well, I'm not. It's not an open offer. It was a specific Friday that someone had canceled.
Yeah, that's good.
But it's interesting because in this space now, there's a lot more political podcasts than there were 6 months ago.
And I like that use of the word space, in the space that we occupy.
Well,
the podcast space, the political podcast space is getting glutted. It's glutted.
No, I don't know that it's glutted, but it's a bunch of different ones.
Do you have any respect for any of them?
The only other podcast I listen to that is about politics is Chapo Trap House.
Yeah.
And I think they perceive themselves as more comedy, supposedly more comedy maybe than politics, but it's political comedy.
Yeah, right.
And it's, they're younger. I mean, they're, you know, that's the thing. It's like, you see all this technology and I think it's much harder to be younger now, to be honest with you, in many respects. But I'm envious of that YouTube exists and that podcasts exist at the beginning of their careers on some level. Because, you know, if I didn't do a daily show when in 2010 or 11 I started mine, it wouldn't have worked because that's what my audience expectations were.
Right.
And to do like two shows a week that I actually produce and plan.
Right, right.
And is something like, oh, I would like to do that, but I don't know that my audience is interested in that. I mean, I don't know if I could get into that rhythm again. You know, to circle it back, I think like the idea that people are presented with a vision of what government and society should be like. I mean, there's a lot of, I think a lot of like the data shit that you see with younger people.
Yeah.
I mean, just in general, is a function of we have to raise our productivity because we're falling behind here. So I have to figure out how to make every moment I have in my day function towards my maintenance of my lifestyle or, you know, just make sure that I can afford to get sick.
Yeah. Ugh. That's a good way to end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to eat?
I do.
What are you eating?
I don't know. Lunch?
Right. But like, are you healthy? Are you not healthy? You want Mexican? You want kind of...
bourbon.
Bourbon. We'll go find some bourbon. Good talking to you, buddy.
Nice talk to you.
That was me and old Sammy. As I said, you can hear Sammy on the Majority Report. You can get it at majority.fm. Okay, it's on at noon every day, live, noon Eastern. It's also available as a podcast. That was Sam Cedar, the lovely Sam Cedar. Bassem Youssef, it's the first time I've met the guy. There's a documentary about him called Tickling Giants. It's available on iTunes and Amazon, as well as at ticklinggiants.com. It premieres on Stars December 18th. He stopped by. Interesting story when a surgeon becomes a comedian. Always surprising. But his story is definitely unique. This is me and Bassem Youssef. So you're living here now.
Yes.
Full time.
Yeah.
You like it seems at the end of the documentary that you were in Harvard Square.
Yeah, I was at Harvard University. I was actually there as a an associate and what do you call it? I was teaching there for a semester.
Oh, really? So that was your first stop? I mean, when you
no. So at that moment,
You fled.
I did flee, but I fled to Dubai.
Okay.
And then I stayed there for a year and 3 months. In within this year and 3 months, I went to Harvard.
Okay.
And I thought that I would stay in Dubai. And then I found out that, like, to stay in the Middle East, there is no way for me to express what I want to say because everything was off the table politically. And I would only stay there. I have to do mindless comedy that doesn't actually talk about issues.
Or medicine.
Oh, right, of course.
There's always the heart surgeon thing.
Yeah, I always have that. But then I left, so I decided to, a year and a half ago, I decided to leave the Middle East altogether and just come here.
Now, what's your status?
Oh, I'm a green card.
Green card.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting. I wasn't familiar completely with the story. I remember hearing about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I know Jon Stewart. Personally, we're not great, but I started out with him in New York, so I know all that what the show is modeled on. But I think what fascinated me, outside of whatever's going on with you now, which I'm curious about, was it, you know, right at the beginning of the story, you kind of make a point to tell us that you know, Mubarak, you know, was in power most of your life.
Absolutely, 30 years.
Now, what fascinated me, only because we have, you know, an attempted authoritarian government happening here, well, what was sort of fascinated me was that you seem like a sophisticated, well-rounded person, and it seems like people living under Mubarak, that there was a cultural community in Egypt. It was fairly, outside of politics, it seemed like everything was functioning, you know, in terms of arts and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, dictators are everywhere. I mean,
oh, I know, yeah.
It's because you guys are not used to that, because you started as
it's
a republic.
It's new to us.
So, for example, if you are a European,
yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, we know how is this.
Like, that's right.
And in our history, we had, I mean, like, look under Hitler.
Sure,
look
Mussolini. I mean, Franco.
I mean, industry.
Yeah.
Arts.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, of course, some of the arts had to be censored, but...
Or politically propaganda.
But dictatorships are generally pretty much functioning.
Yeah.
Not like the way that you want them functioning, but for many, it is functioning. And for many, you will be allowed to have arts and you'll be allowed to have some sort of freedom of expression within the realms of what the state would consider acceptable. For us, I mean... what should we do? Should we leave our lives and our livelihood and just go into the streets and revolt? We never thought that is possible until 2011.
Right. So, but when you were a kid and when you went into your successful heart surgeon, yes?
Yep.
Like you know how to do that.
To what? To go to the streets?
No, to be a heart surgeon.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, because I'm a nerd. I am a freaking nerd. This is what we do.
Yeah, I know, but you committed to, like, you went through a lot of years of medical school.
Yeah.
And you did, now in Egypt.
Because in Egypt, if you're not an engineer or a medical doctor, you don't count.
Really?
For your parents.
Oh, for your parents. So it was pressure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you have a...
You think I went to medicine because of passion? Fuck that.
Well, come on. I mean, it is important. I mean, you know, saving lives is not a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh. You really resent medicine?
No, I don't resent medicine. I resent the lifestyle.
Now, but you as a practice, you know, as a doctor, how did it work in Egypt? Were you able to make a lot of money? Is it the same here? I mean, did you?
No, in Egypt, to make a lot of money as a doctor, you, especially in heart surgery, you don't really see any money until your 40s.
Uh huh.
And it's a very long path, and it's not, and the system is just horrible.
The health system,
how it works, and there it is basically a no system.
Yeah.
And
what does that mean?
I mean, here in the United States, there is a path.
Yeah.
You know that you're going to be a resident,
yeah.
then you're going to be an attending, then you're going to be there. And you know that, like, if you're good, you know that you're fine somewhere to host you as a doctor, and you can totally depend on your work in the hospital, and that will provide for you.
Yeah.
There, you have to hustle.
Yeah.
You have to, it's all about, it's more of a business more than actually a practice. It is, you have to hustle your private practices, and you have to, a portion of your life you'll have to be like doing in your clinic, and then you go to this hospital and to that hospital. You have to work 3, 4, 5 hospitals at the same time in order to provide.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. So now, okay, so you're just going along your life. You have one child at that time, it seemed. And
no, my child came 2012.
Oh, okay. So, and you guys were just living under Mubarak, and that was just the way things were. It wasn't great, but you knew what was up.
It was a very slow, painful decay, but it was okay.
What compelled the initial riots? Was it economically Egypt faltering? I don't know the history.
Well, the thing is, everybody was inspired by what happened in Tunisia.
Yeah.
They revolted against Ben Ali, their dictator, and fled, and kind of like it made everybody hungry.
Yeah.
But even after that, the demonstrations in Egypt didn't start as we want to get rid of Mubarak. It was they wanted to get rid of the minister of police because of police brutality.
Uh-huh.
And when the first wave in 25th of January was oppressed by the police and by the bullets and by the gas,
yeah,
it turned automatically to, all right, we want Mubarak down. So as the regime was slow to respond, the expectations of the protesters increased. And then it became a sit-in and it became like, all right, no Mubarak or bust, basically. And Mubarak had to step down after 18
but,
days.
But not before, you know, shooting people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like maybe 1,000 people were killed.
In the streets.
Yeah.
Just gunned down by Mubarak's police.
Less than maybe 400. I can't remember the numbers of the 18 days, but a lot of people were gunned down.
And the gassing and the beating and it was not stoppable.
It's not stoppable, no.
And when that happened for you as a doctor, what was your first... what was your first impulse? Because you were okay. You were set, you were working.
Many of the people who actually led the demonstrations were okay.
Yeah.
They were financially very independent.
Yeah.
They were more educated than others. They had more awareness than others. And this is why when people say, why do you want to revolt? You're doing okay. It's like, yeah, but the country was not doing okay. And this is why change has to come from people who are aware and can provide for themselves, because they go for the ideology of things, not because of the necessity of having more food.
Right.
Because if that was the thing, I'll give you more food, then it's
solved.
Done.
Problem solved.
So as a doctor, I mean, we were under Mubarak, everybody kind of like accepted it as like a matter of fact, but when you see, oh my God, can we actually live without Mubarak? So we got excited.
Yeah.
During the 18 days, my role was just limited to being a guy who would go to the makeshift clinic in Tahrir Square and try to fix the wounds and just like stitch people up.
Yeah.
I was not a guy who would in the front lines throwing rocks because I have a very bad aim.
Was that it? But you had a purpose and you were helping people and you were. So when Mubarak did resign, people were ecstatic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But they didn't really know what would happen next.
There was no manual.
Yeah.
There was no manual for what would happen next. And because of for 30 years, the political life was basically at standstill.
Yeah.
There was no dynamic of what does it mean to be political. So the only people who were ready were the Muslim Brotherhood.
Uh-huh.
And the Muslim Brotherhood were a very good pick for the military who were basically ran everything, because both of them are on the conservative side. So there was, as if there was some sort of an unwritten agreement between them, is like, you know what, you do whatever you want as military, still control yourself, only you have your autonomy, nobody will come close to you.
Right.
And we can control the people, which is pretty much like Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
And what would, this is what we were worried about, that we were turned into a Pakistan. And
which means what specifically?
Which means that the military rule the country and the Islamists rule the streets.
Right.
And then a couple of years under the Islamists, a year in the parliament and a year in presidency.
Of Morsi. Yeah.
People were fed up with the Islamists because they were just like pushing their conservative agenda more and more. I know that, like, when Americans hear about Islamist rule, the first thing that comes to them is Sharia law.
Right.
It's not like that. It is creating the atmosphere of because we are Islamists, we're better than you. And because we are Islamists, we are going to crack down of the secular values that many people want.
Oh, so they're righteous and they have a moral code that is Islam.
Yeah, they will never come to you. I mean, to be fair, the Muslim Brotherhood will never say, oh, we're going to go and behead people in the streets. They will not going to say this.
No,
however,
it just sort of happens.
What?
It just sort of starts happening.
No, they will never say that. But the thing is, again, it is about like, what is right and what is wrong.
Right.
And the fact that they would unite with the more radical people, which is the Salafis, which is the pretty much the uber Muslims.
Yeah.
And the thing is, my own interpretation is that the army was happy with that. It's like, you know what? Like, yeah. I mean, like, as if we're getting our thing. But I think what happened is that I think the army and the Muslim Brotherhood started to have their differences on who to run the country economically.
Right. And the weird thing is that, like, you know, I kept watching this in light of, you know, what's happening in America, and also having, you know, been through Bush and the power of the sort of Christian right. I mean, there is a faction within this country that believes in the same sort of righteousness, and that it must be applied to culture.
But for here, they will stop at short at abortion and gay rights.
Mm-hmm.
In Egypt or in the Arab world in general, it will be more than this.
Yeah.
It will be the minimum age of marriage. It will be what is forbidden or not. It will be cracking down on freedom of expression. However, to complete the story, because like if you're talking about the Islamists, is the military a better option? So the military took over, and the military is still a very conservative institution. And
it's right and wrong by the gun.
Right and wrong by the gun, and still using religious like justifications.
Right, right.
But it's just like, oh, our Islam is better than their Islam.
Right.
But even under Mubarak, the supposedly secular leader, and under Sisi, the supposedly secular military dictator, there are so many people who've been jailed and persecuted because they tried to spread religious reforms. There are so many people who spoke in order to reform the radical narratives, and they were either being sent to exile or jailed, persecuted. It was not the people with the beard and the
right
and the religious cloth that were doing that. It was the military and the police,
because they saw that the Islamists had a structure through which to keep the people in line.
It's simply because if I'm a military dictator and you come and start to question things in religion, so today you're going to start to question religion, tomorrow you're going to question me,
right?
So for them, religion is always a first line of defense. And this if you look to the arc of military dictatorships in the Arab world, even the Islamic world, that's not new. Sadat, who was like America's best friend, 1980s, he was the one who actually put in Sharia law not Sharia, Sharia as the source of legislation in the Egyptian constitution 1980 in order to have unlimited times of re-election. It was Zia-ul-Haq in Pakistan who turned the constitution in an Islamic constitution in order to get to be on the good side of the radicals in the streets in Pakistan to protect him against the army, and still didn't protect him. It was Jafar Nimeiri in 1988, I guess, who after a failed policies of military dictatorship couldn't find anything that works other than turning the whole country into a Sharia abiding Islamic republic.
Right.
It is always the religious narrative and the religious enforcement is what dictatorship always do as
to
protect themselves.
This is good information for us in America right
now. So it's always people think, oh, we are afraid of those like religious fanatics. We're going to go to the military because they have to be secular. They're not.
Yeah.
Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, who are supposedly secular, they used religion big time.
Yeah.
And they always use that to protect their regime.
So are you Muslim?
Yeah.
Are you religious?
I prefer to keep that to myself.
Out of fear of who?
Not out of fear, because I this is something that started with me in Egypt. Whenever people start to ask me, "Are you Muslim?" Like, why do you ask? Why the fuck do you care? And because it's a little bit sensitive back there, because people want to see where are your, how are you affiliated to us in order so we can speak to you. It's like, you should speak to me as a human being.
Oh, the reason I ask.
Yes.
Is that, you know, there's this belief that there are no moderate Muslims in America.
Oh, I can speak to that. So the idea of no moderate Muslim could be easily believed because what do you see in the news?
Yeah.
And I will be even more forward, like, well, maybe the vast majority are not. And maybe you have statistics that would support the narrative that most Muslims in the world are pretty much radicalized. And I would partly agree with this narrative because... But the problem with Islam is not a problem of Islamic ideology or dogmatic problem.
Yeah.
It is a problem of free expression and free speech. Because many of the free expression, many of the ideas that are more forward are oppressed not by the Islamic authorities, but more by governments. You do not have this kind of conversation. The conservative radical Islam is protected by the state.
Yeah.
So you don't have this kind of conversation.
You can't be critical. There's no talk of reform or anything.
So that kind of a radicalized thought is protected. So when you look at the Muslims outside, because they live in secular societies.
Yeah.
You have a totally different picture.
Mm-hmm.
You will find people who can speak freely. I mean, like in Germany, just like in the past 3 months, there was a liberal mosque that was open in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And the imams are women and gays.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in Germany, which is
So you're saying that once the individual is removed from the oppressive Islamist situation.
Not the oppressive Islamists, the oppressive political situation in general.
Okay, right.
So, and because that will bring up
which sometimes are the same.
Sometimes they are and sometimes they're not.
Okay.
But it's always the military regime is always protecting itself with the Islamic, because it's easier to say like, how come you speak against God
than how come
you speak against me? So when you have that, you have now an array of ideas that they can compete in a free market.
Right.
And they will still be rejected by the mainstream. And this is a generational issue.
Mainstream Islam?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is why you have right now in America and in Europe, look at the second generation, the younger Muslims. They are like totally different than their parents.
Yeah.
There is a big generational divide.
In terms of how they handle their religion.
So, and to bring that to the comparison between Christianity, but Christianity got reformed. I'm sorry, Christianity was never reformed. For Christianity, it's the same Bible. The same Bible, the same Old Testament, New Testament, with all of the controversial verses of how you treat women, how you beat women, how you kill women if they don't obey their husbands.
Right.
But the difference was that the Christian societies evolved.
Right.
But the scripture stayed the same. So you can have the same thing. The whole thing about like Islam could not be reformed is you don't need to reform Islam. The scripture will always be there.
Yeah.
It is just like how societies would choose how to deal with the scripture.
So when did you get compelled? At what point in the political narrative of Egypt did you feel like you had to, you know, speak out, or that you took the opportunity to do the show?
Well, 6 weeks after Mubarak stepped down, I had a friend of mine who was a YouTube partner and who wanted to start. It was an ongoing conversation even a year before the revolution. He wanted to have original Arabic content for YouTube, which at that time was non-existent.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So we started to talk about other projects, but it didn't like actually go through. But like when the revolution happened, kind of the opportunity like delivered itself. Like, why don't you do something political? It's like, I want to do Jon Stewart because I was a big fan of The Daily Show. And I started to do that show in my apartment once a week. In the weekend, after I come back from hospital, I would do like these like YouTube videos.
Segments.
Yeah, so like 5 minutes videos. I didn't expect that they will have any traction. Maybe 10,000 views will be a wonderful number. And then four or five weeks later, I had like 5 million.
And what was the tone of them? Was it just sarcasm?
It was making fun of how the media brainwashed the people during the 18 days. It was like reminding people, like, this is the kind of media that was playing on television while you guys were in the streets.
It was sort of insane to see how crazy Egyptian television was.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Oh, this like,
because I didn't know what they were saying, but it seemed political, all the fighting, or was it
100% political?
I mean, like literally physical confrontations
and people
and you guys,
throwing chairs.
And
people,
apparently, it's okay to say fuck a lot on television.
It's never okay. It's always beat. But the thing is, what the documentary didn't show is the kind of material that I used, because the kind of material that I used might not be translate easily
right
to English. It was whatever it takes for the media to convince people that this was a conspiracy. For the media in Egypt, this was not a revolution. It was a conspiracy that was carried by the CIA, the Mossad, Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas all together.
The protests.
Yeah.
Arab
all
Spring.
Of this, they were like, all of these people are paid operatives.
Sure. They try that here too. Yeah.
Yes.
So there's a playbook for this shit.
It is. They say the playbook of dictatorship is very slim.
Mm-hmm.
It is the same thing. It's fear-mongering. If you want to summarize the playbook of dictatorships and authoritarians everywhere, whether religious or military or stupid ass motherfuckers, orange heads, it all comes down to one thing: fear from the other.
Yeah,
I'll create an enemy. I'll make you afraid of it. I'm gonna make you afraid shitless of that enemy, and I'm going to push legislation and policies based on that fear, and you're gonna accept it.
Yeah. And eventually, through repetition, people start to believe it because they're scared.
Absolutely.
They're scared of other things.
Absolutely. I mean,
they should be scared of the person pushing that.
Yeah,
but they can't register.
No. So I was in Politicon just a few days ago, and I was in a room where a lot of like red caps were just like emerging of Make America Great Again.
Yeah.
And people's like, oh, Islam! And you're all coming into it. I was like, guys, I mean, just like, you know, yeah, all right. Guys, by the way, we're on the same side. You're like, all of these images that you see in the media, I mean, those people, if they see me, they kill me too. But like, you are just like, what really bugs me. It's like, guys, you are here in America where you idealize individuality. Everybody's an individual. It's like you guys worship the individual, how everybody is different and how everybody should be treated different because of his own merits. But you come to us and you group us. We are just like the exception of the rule, where everything that's happening back there. And I don't even like to say, well, we are 1.7 billion people, and if we want to kill you, we're only going to be killed, and the vast majority of Muslims are peace-loving. You know what? 99% of Muslims want to kill you. But you should actually like deal us as if you're dealing with the 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I really don't have to respond or have held accountable to whoever is doing that shit. So when you have like refugee problems, you already having one of the most toughest vetting processes in
right.
the world.
Yeah.
But the other side want to tell you that it is the system is broken. The system is not fucking broken.
No, they just don't want any more Muslims here. The brown people in general are not.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's Muslims or Mexicans or whatever. And I tell them, like, guys, discrimination does not discriminate. Because, all right, so let's say we're just like all pieces of shit Muslims. All of those Muslims are a clear and present danger. What about those three Indians that were killed in the middle of America?
Yeah.
They were Indian Sikhs. They're not Middle Easterns. They're not Muslims. They're just brown. What about this?
Do you have these conversations with these guys?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What about like the Lebanese Christian guy who were killed in the porch of his house because the guy's like, go back to your country. He's Lebanese. He's Christian. So, I mean...
How do they respond?
They don't respond because they have nothing to say. They're just, oh, but Islam wants to kill us. It's just like the same broken record.
Sure.
I mean, as a matter of fact, the first victim of hate crimes after 9/11 was an Egyptian Christian Copt.
Cop?
A Copt is like an Orthodox Christian.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was having a convenience store and he was shot in his store. So... It doesn't stop that because, like, spoiler alert, we pretty much look the same.
Yeah. And when you, okay, so you're doing the YouTube videos in your house or your partner's house. What was his name? Tariq?
Tariq. It was in my house.
Yeah, it's your house.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to see the popularity. You start to see that at least a good portion or a lot of people are responding and they see what you're talking about. So how does it move from there?
At that time I was waiting to go to Cleveland because I was having, I was actually applied and I was accepted in a pediatric heart surgery fellowship. And I was waiting for the H-1 visas, which will be something that we don't have anymore soon.
Was it the Mayo Clinic?
No. It's the Children's Hospital in Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
Rainbow Children's Hospital, very, very prestigious children's hospital there. And when I was waiting for the H-1 visa, for the papers to come, and I was waiting for that, I was just doing the show, and then I started to have offers from networks in Egypt. And then the same day I was signing the contract for for an Egyptian network there, the visa papers arrived.
Uh-huh.
And I just, it was a choice.
Was that a tough conversation with your wife?
My wife is the most supportive woman. It was a tough conversation with my mom.
Oh, yeah.
But as a matter of fact, it was not as tough as I imagined it would be because as any other Middle Eastern woman, it's like, oh, you know, better have my friends closer, my enemy closer. That means that she needs her sons closer to her. So yeah. She said, fine. Let's give it a try, and for her, just to be around her and the same country is better for her, of course.
Yeah.
So I said, like, all right, let's postpone this medicine thing for a year, and let's take a shot.
It's so funny. As a comic, I've known plenty of lawyers that have gone into comedy. I don't think I've known many doctors.
I know.
It's a rare, and I guess you feel like you did the right thing. You're still doing it.
Yep.
So, I get it. But okay, so it's a big risk on a lot of levels, and you take this gig. Now, there's no real precedent for a political comedy show or in Egypt, but you seem to, from the documentary, it seems like you amassed a bunch of very energetic, focused, and funny people to do this thing. How did you find them?
It was tough because first I started to hire people who were already in the business.
And what was that business like there? There were comedy shows in Egypt? What were
they? They were, but like...
Very broad?
Just like very boring.
Yeah.
And I started to hire the best in the business and I fired them after 8 weeks.
Because they didn't have the guts or they just couldn't do it?
Because the business as usual in Egypt, the idea of hiring someone to write full time for a show was unheard of.
Yeah.
Most of the late night shows there were just conversational talk show, very boring, where like a journalist who would just like work part time or work full time in a newspaper and come at the end of the night as a part time to work in the
right
in the talk show.
Okay,
I demanded absolute dedication to the show.
And you're using The Daily Show as your template, as yes. your inspiration, as yes. the way it's supposed to be done.
Exactly. And people didn't understand that.
Why? You'd show them The Daily Show and they didn't get it?
They got it, but it's like it's not going to be done in Egypt. Everybody, just like everybody was putting me down. It's just too Americanized. Dude, whatever happens in America cannot be replicated in Egypt.
But was it about the content? Was it about fear of the government? Or was
No.
Wouldn't be funny.
It's two things. So on the level of the staff,
yeah.
Nobody will just work full time for a show. And for the level of the networks, it's like nobody will watch this.
Yeah.
And when I
but they hired you.
Yeah, they did. But when I was started to demand bigger amount of money to do the Daily Show, the live show, people said like, this is too much money. No, the size of TV advertisement in Egypt cannot support this thing.
Oh, and when he brought the audience.
Yeah, and I was like, you're having all of this money for a weekly show. Nobody will come. Nobody will watch it. And then I said, if you create content, you will create market.
Yeah.
And nobody believed it.
So you do the first season at which network?
On TV, which is the small TV network.
And it was called The Show.
Yes. And I continued with the second season with the live show, and which was like, that was something that really disrupted the scene there.
But when you get, okay, so you're on TV, you're in the this is when it's before, is it after Morsi or?
No, I started before Morsi.
Right. So it was that weird area where no one knew what was going to happen.
Exactly.
Just the military.
Yes.
And you get
but
on,
it was the military, but with the obvious rise of the Islamic movement in the parliament.
Right. So you get on TV and it's an immediate success?
Yes. It was the first a slow success because it was a small network and yeah. the budget was small.
Right.
And that was the
first. How many networks are there there?
Oh, I can. Maybe 8 or 9.
Okay.
No, there were many, but the ones that were watched were 8 and 9.
Yeah.
But, and then I started to do the second season, which I started to want to look for financing, and people would just think, that's too much money. You want to rent a theater?
Yeah.
Seriously? You want to get like real audience?
Yeah.
Nobody can be behind that. We actually got a piece of shit theater that was like abandoned for 15 years.
Uh-huh.
And we spent so much money renovating it and doing it. It's like, that's so much money. Why are you doing that?
And this is the second season.
That was the second season, yes.
So after the first season, now you're a huge celebrity.
Yep.
In Egypt.
Yep.
Everybody knows who you are.
Yes.
No one's ever done what you've done before.
No.
But are you nervous yet?
Oh, I'm very nervous all the time.
About what could happen to you.
Yes.
Because you knew that, you know, that you may be on borrowed time.
Yes, exactly. I was expecting, when will this run end? Yeah.
But when did, like, okay, so you do the first season successful, you renovate the theater, you go into the second season, you've got a live audience now.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point is Morsi elected?
Morsi is elected before my second season launches.
So now you've got a whole new set of issues.
Yes.
Before you were talking about the media, you were talking about the military and the Muslim Brotherhood in a broad way, but now you've got a guy.
I've got a president.
Yeah. So now the stakes are higher.
The stakes are much higher.
Uh-huh.
And now it is now a show and the size of audience is increasing.
Uh-huh.
And I ended up after the 10th week having 30 to 40 million people watching the show.
So that's not just Egypt.
No, that's Egypt.
That's all just Egypt.
Yeah. And outside, there were even more.
That's what I mean. Oh, really?
Yeah. It was watching.
So the Arab world.
The Arab world was watching. Everybody in the Arab world.
And I imagine they're entertained. Their minds are blown. But some of them are like, he's going to get killed, this guy.
Yeah. People were just like, oh, my God. I mean, we never had something like this. It's we made something. We took something that was unheard of and made it mainstream.
And you really did what John does in the sense that you really were taking shots at Morsi day in, you know, every week.
But not just Morsi. Morsi was just a representative. I took shots of the whole Islamic regime and their media, mostly their media. Because for me, I'm always like, all right, you know what? All right, Morsi is Morsi. And the Islamic regime is Islamic regime. But what about their mouthpieces? What about their Breitbarts?
Yeah.
What about their Fox News?
Yeah.
What about their
Were they state-owned there? Those networks?
The religious?
No, like the network, the media that you're talking about.
No, they're privately owned.
Okay.
Yeah. But you find out that, but like later, all of them is now acquired by the state with shell companies.
Oh, that's the way it is now? Or, mm-hmm. or was it always that way?
It's the way it is now.
Okay, so now this is where things start to get hotter. Now you've got an enemy who is the president.
Yep.
And now at what point did you start, actively fearing for your life and in the sense of being disappeared or imprisoned or
I never had this fear.
Because I noticed that in the documentary, when it shows you reacting to criticism and the anger in the streets, that you seem to be kind of detached from it. I didn't know if that was real or not.
It was actually quite real. And what is good about Sarah and how she captured this, because
Sarah Taxler,
the director of the movie, is that I watched this movie for the first time ever on the premiere of the movie in Tribeca Film Festival last year. I never saw any.
The documentary. What is it? What's the full name of the documentary?
Tickling Giants.
Yeah, Tickling Giants.
And I didn't have any expectations. I just watched there. I watched it as any other part of the audience. And when I saw the footage of me, as you said, pretty much detached.
It's yeah.
Like, my God, this is what I really felt. I didn't really care about what will happen to me. Because if you die, you die. If you're killed, you're killed, right?
Is that something you always felt, or is that something you learned from being a heart surgeon?
No, it is in the media. Because in the media, you're very exposed. Everything that you say is out there.
Yeah.
I was more concerned. I was more terrified about giving a bad show.
And I imagine for your staff to some degree.
Yeah, just like for us, it's like we were raising the bar higher and higher and higher. And you cannot drop from that.
Mm-hmm. So when did the state start coming down on you? At what point?
Well, there were many points. There were during the Muslim Brotherhood when I was, there was a warrant for my arrest. And
Before Morsi?
No, within Morsi. Towards the end of his presidency.
The second season.
Mm, yeah. And when I went to the general prosecutor and I had a 6 hours interrogation. And it was funny because I felt that as if they were like asking, why is this funny? Which is the worst thing they can tell for a comedian.
Sure.
And then there was like, the tension was rising in the streets.
They would hold bits up? They would show you bits?
Yeah, exactly. And it was just,
it's like Lenny Bruce and when they were reading his bits.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that
was it, exactly.
But they had a TV in the courtroom?
No, it's not a courtroom. So it was the office, in his office. And this is a funny story because they had the stuff on CDs.
Yeah.
And they tried to play the CDs on a very outdated 1995 Windows computer.
Uh-huh.
And they couldn't work the CDs. And I said, like, guys, let me help you.
Yeah.
And then it didn't work. And then, all right, we're just going to read the transcript.
Yeah.
So that was.
And how did you answer those questions? Why is this funny?
I mean, they were. No, the question was basically, what did you mean by this?
Oh.
I said, well, I meant it exactly as it is. And because of my satire, it was basically double meaning.
Yeah.
So if you read it out, it's like, oh, it's so innocent. And I said, like, well, if that's the case, why are people laughing?
Yeah.
And I said, like, I don't know. Why don't you ask them?
So it's basic sarcasm.
Yeah.
So you say it in a tone.
Yeah.
So they hadn't watched the show.
No, they do. Well, the thing is, the general prosecutor was doing his job.
Yeah.
But in the room, there were other lawyers from the general prosecutor office, and all of them were fans of the show. And they were laughing their asses off during the investigation. And it was like surreal, like having actually to go there as someone who is... under arrest.
Yeah.
And having all of these police officers and lawyers having pictures with me. Yeah. It was really insane.
That's funny. Because that's a, you know, then you kind of, you really see that the streets are with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got off on that one.
Yeah, I got off on the on bail, but the pressure from the Islamic government continued, and Hussein always started to have warnings. If you make fun of the president, we're going to close down the show. But then fast forward a few weeks after, we had the 30th of June where the military took over.
After Morsi?
Basically they removed Morsi. And then the Islamists were on the weaker side now, and they got killed in the streets, and they were... In one day, 800 people got killed by the military.
It was Islamists?
Yes. And it was a big massacre. And now I have a new power in a new power, which is the military. And I was popular. I was the national hero who took down the Muslim Brotherhood, the one who made fun of the president of the Islamists.
So now a lot of people are dead, yes. And they haven't shut you down yet. And you've got a new foil.
Yeah, and now... And I did one episode, and that was enough to shut me down by the military.
So you're off the air?
I'm off the air after one episode under the military rule. And it was funny because all of those people who were cheering me up, whatever, oh, he had it coming. You shouldn't make fun of the military. The people who were applauding me for making fun of the Islamists couldn't get a single word of criticism or joke against the military. They're including people from my own family. That was an Egyptian network who shut me down after one episode.
Yeah.
And then I stayed unemployed for 4 months. And then I went to a regional network, Saudi owned. And I told them, no, but I mean, I know that you're Saudi owned, but like I will not have anybody interfering in my content. And they had an Egyptian channel where I worked in that Egyptian channel. And I continued for that season for 11 weeks. And I was shut down again indefinitely.
After the move to the Saudi network with the Egyptian channel.
Yes.
And that was the end?
That was the end.
So, okay, so I'm just trying to, you know, connect it to what I saw in the documentary. So now you go back on the air after you're shut down with the new regional network. Mm-hmm. You've held your line on being able to say what you want to say. There was that episode where they scrambled your signal.
Two episodes.
And that was, you know, after you signed with the Saudi network.
On the regional end, yes.
So, and it's pretty clear that that was done intentionally by the military. And then now you're dealing with protesters out front, right?
Yeah, people coming, and they're all staged protests. They are like stuff that are pushed by the military intelligence. It's like it's a very old technique that they always use. It's just like fake protests that go in so to show that the people are against what I'm saying. Of course, there are a lot of people who kind of hated me for what I'm saying now, but they wouldn't just like go in and burn.
I was surprised at how many older women yelling and screaming and throwing their finger.
They're all paid by the government. Oh, yeah. All of them are paid. And we had footage of them appearing in similar protests to kind of like push a certain agenda or narrative.
Oh, so they've got a whole crew.
They are like professionals.
Yeah, they're angry extras.
Yeah, exactly. I think the military could be the best casting agencies out there.
What was profound to me is that, you know, despite the propaganda and you know these paid extras, it did seem like a lot of people, I don't know if it was out of fear or just the lack of stability or whether it was because it was Egypt, that there seemed to be a lot of people that wanted to be under authoritarian.
Well, you cannot really look at Egypt in a vacuum. I mean,
yeah.
So here's the media narrative. If we don't do this, look to what happened to Iraq, Syria, and Libya. Look to the countries around us. We are the last standing Arab army. They are coming for us. If you look at what's happening in Syria, look to ISIS, look to Libya. Do you want your country ruled by militias? Democracy means chaos.
Right.
So they already have pretty much a good point. I mean, look to the other countries around us. Look, this is how the Arab Spring are spoiling the people.
I know,
around
but those
us.
Were all dictatorships.
I know.
So they're still vulnerable, even if they say, look what happened.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
to the people that are scared, they'll be like,
"That doesn't matter." I mean, are you talking logic now?
Yeah, right.
I mean, are you trying to be logical?
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, under fear, logic, let alone satire, is not accepted.
Right. So your fight to continue to say what you wanted to say and do it the way you wanted to do it, which was not, the funny thing is, it wasn't angry, it wasn't violent, it was satire. And it was, you know, I think that in some ways it's harder for them to deal with that because they actually don't always know why people are laughing.
Yeah. I mean, because here's the thing. Laughter is the greatest threat to them because these authoritarian regimes build their legitimacy on two major things: respect and fear.
Right. And El Sisi,
and this is why someone like Donald Trump doesn't like to be laughed at.
I know. There's a lot of reasons, but yeah.
Because if you laugh at him, you're undermining his authority, his respect.
But he was always a clown before. He was like, you know,
doesn't matter. But even when he was a clown, he was the clown in control.
Right.
And he's the guy who's firing people on his show.
Right.
So you can make fun of me. You cannot really make fun of me. I'm the president. Yeah. He doesn't have the idea or the concept of what does it mean to be a public servant.
Sure.
And this is why that was very apparent. He was the only president to break in tradition to say, all right, I'm not going to come to the correspondence dinner. Good luck. Have fun.
Yeah. No, I know. I believe me. I feel it every day. It's driving me nuts. But when someone like Sisi comes in, we didn't really talk about, because he was, during your last season, that was when he came to power, correct?
Yeah.
It was interesting the theatrics of him. It's almost a farce. The sunglasses, the whole business. You know, when you look at it, it's like people really believe that means something.
Yeah, this is what powers mean to them.
Yeah. So, did you feel at that time that your life was in danger?
I think the whole time I was in denial.
Post-traumatic stress or denial?
I was in denial to actually believe that my life would be in danger.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't function.
If you felt that?
I couldn't function. I couldn't write jokes. I couldn't be on the show. I mean...
Because, I mean, despite, you know, your chipper disposition and the detachment, I mean, I found it kind of, impressive and it seemed very courageous that you know, you continue to do a show at all.
Yes. I mean, it was funny. We were doing the show and we were betting which show will be the last one.
Uh-huh.
But we were being in a nihilistic state of mind.
But when they put your partner, your producer's father in prison for no reason, did you see that as a signal to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely a signal. And I thought that, like, if I continue doing a good show, having a high rating, that would somehow protect me.
Protect you. And what about your family? Were there threats?
No, but they were always worried.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, you really have to define what threats mean. Are you talking about online threats?
No.
Are you talking about Twitter or whatever? Because I have that all the time.
No, of course. No, I'm talking about being visited by the military.
No, I was visited by... in the theater by a friend. I had a friendly visit by someone from the intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
Who, offering his help.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of like, we're watching you.
Yeah. Hi, how are you? Yeah. So now, when the show goes down, when you're done, and now, was there public outcry? Or were they not able to do that, really?
Not able. It's basically on the internet.
Okay, so...
As a matter of fact, many of them were angry at me. You pussy, come back and fight. And seriously, what are you going to do for me? You're just like there on Twitter and Facebook, you know, doing anything.
Yeah, you did. There was some pushback in the sense that, you know, once you were off the air, what were you supposed to do, hit the streets? I mean, what did they expect from you? You had no control over the outlet.
I mean, it's just like as if you're saying like, oh, as if you are coming back to the age of Hitler and Mussolini and like, why did you stop making fun of the Fuhrer or why of Mussolini? Go back.
Yeah.
Go back, make fun of Il Duce. It's like, what are you going to do if something happened to me? I'm just going to write angry tweets.
Yeah.
Supporting you.
That was bound to happen.
I mean, it's just like...
But you did not want to stay engaged with any sort of resistance. I mean, there was other ways, I imagine. Or are you telling me there's no resistance at all?
But I mean, the resistance are I mean, I have to be very realistic here and say the resistance is crushed, and they, you can, at the end of the day, you have a critical mass. But the critical mass of people, if they're not supported by the people, they will be squashed.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is, if you just have the same 10, 12 people moving masses and they're getting crushed, and the people just don't move a finger and they're just like behind their computer screens, so basically fuck them. I'll be very honest.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is that you just can't. And I never presented myself as a political activist. But like, you try to resist with the tools that you have, which is political satire.
Yeah.
And if you end up being crushed every time, and people just sitting there asking you to do more, and when you go into the street, when you get imprisoned, you just like, they have like a whole kind of hashtag supporting you. Fuck that.
Yeah.
There are so many people that I know who are in the, they have their family destroyed, they are in prison, and the hashtag didn't do anything to them. And and of course, people, so why don't you continue doing it from YouTube, from outside?
Yeah.
So, well, I was doing it from a TV show, from inside. What happened? Did it change anything? Nothing. You just want someone to be your catharsis, your outlet, to just like laugh your ass off, hoping that this will change the regime. It will not.
Right. You got to get into the streets.
I mean, I can't ask them to do that.
Right.
Because it's too dangerous to them too. I mean, I don't have a solution. I don't have an answer.
Yeah.
I'm just a guy. I'm just a guy who does joke. Uh-huh. I am not a fucking Nelson Mandela.
Right. I understand. So when, so you saw the lawsuit, you know, as that was how they were going to punish you.
Yeah, because the lawsuit is like just like a way, an indirect way to put you down without.
And that was your second network.
Yes.
Suing you for content they couldn't.
No, that's the second, the network that shut me down after one episode. That's my second season.
But not the regional network, not the Saudi network.
No, the Egyptian one.
And what was the lawsuit specifically?
Oh my God, it's just, they shut me down.
Yeah.
And then we went to arbitration. And there's no way that I would lose the arbitration because the one who shut me down. And yet the arbitration find a way to hold me responsible. And I found myself like owning them £100 million, which is like at that time, $50 million.
$50 million?
15.
Oh, $15 million
it's
for...
still a lot.
It's a lot. For a season that you couldn't do.
Because I left them and I went to another episode. Like, I was just like, well, you know, because I had to go to another episode, another network, I had to get out of that contract.
Right.
So I made all of the legal steps. We thought we were right, and then they just like, I was screwed.
So okay, so it comes down. So that's in court, and then you know you're told that you lose, and you're on the hook for $15 million.
Yes.
And you just leave.
I escaped. Yeah, the verdict was at 12 noon, and I escaped at 5.
Were you prepared for that?
No, I was. I just took two suitcases and head to the airport.
Really? You didn't, in your mind, you're like, well, if this comes down this way, I'm going to go? You decided that day?
Yeah. I didn't decide that day. I mean, the lawyer said, like, you have to leave fucking now. Yeah. Because this is a way they're going to use to either put you on a no-fly list, so you better go out before that door is shut, or it's a way for them to put you in prison.
And you took your family?
No, I traveled alone, yeah. And then they followed after a few weeks.
They didn't hold them?
No.
So they kind of wanted you out.
Maybe.
Or they would have, you know, made it hard for your family, I would have thought.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know how these regimes work. We need to talk to the guy who's giving the orders.
Oh, yeah. They're always very forthcoming.
Yeah.
So you come here, you do the thing at Harvard, you're in Dubai. You think you're going to stay in Dubai, but you still want to do comedy.
Yeah.
And then you do the...
But the only comedy that's offered to me is social comedy, like late night, stupid stuff.
Right.
And I couldn't do that. I was offered a shitload of money to do it. And then I just like, I couldn't, and I left.
And so now you end up here in Los Angeles, the home of show business, with your wife and now two children. Do you have two children?
Yeah. One of them is 5 and one of them is 5 years and the other one is 5 days.
Oh, you must be tired.
A bit, yes.
And what have you been doing in the States? I mean, what are you just kicking around?
Well, I have my own one-man show that I take it around, and it's kind of chronicles the Egyptian revolution through the eyes of the media.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun show. And
where do you do that generally?
It depends. So I do it in university campuses. I performing arts theaters.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You doing okay with that?
Oh, yeah, I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
And I wrote the book and did the, and then we had the...
is the book out?
The book is out since March. It's mm-hmm. called Revolution for Dummies. And so I'm doing that, which is putting food on the table, which is great. But like in the meantime, I'm doing what every Hollywood resident is doing, waiting for the big break. So I'm working on projects, writing scripts, pitching ideas, attending meetings, which is like, you know, Hollywood is a life of rejection until something big happens.
But you were a national hero.
I know. And I could actually stayed and use that for my... I could have actually stayed and do a shitload of money there, but I chose to come here and start from zero.
So that, well, that's the odd thing that if you did that play into it, that if you would have stayed and you would have had a television show, whether it was out of Dubai or on a regional network that went into Egypt and you were neutered, you were, you know, you could no longer do political satire. That's almost like a different type of prison.
Yeah. I would still like earn shitload of money,
but people who thought that you know, the ones that said you pussy, you know, why are you leaving, then if you were on TV doing nothing, they that would have been like almost like watching a brainwashed person.
Absolutely. As you said, neutered, as you said. But it's always, it's not, it just, I don't do that out of like patriotic beliefs or anything. It's just like this is not how satire works.
Right.
It's going to be something different. It is like having, it is something also I couldn't do.
Yeah.
It is like having LeBron James. All right, why don't you play football? It's like, I can't.
Right.
I that's not my thing.
Now, when you perform here, do you get a good reaction?
Yeah. I mean, they're very successful, almost sold out theaters, mixed audience of Arab and non-Arabs, which is great.
And do you have, what's your experience with American Egyptians in terms of, you know?
Well, most of the people I met here are wonderful people.
Yeah.
And very, very good people. And I'm blessed to have met amazing friends here in Los Angeles.
Are there any Egyptian Americans that are pro Sisi?
There are many.
Yeah.
There are many. And yeah, there are many Egyptian Americans who are pro-Muslim Brotherhood.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully I will stay away from both of these circles.
Do they heckle you?
No, but I was heckled twice in London and in New York. And it was, these were people who were paid by the Egyptian consulate to come and actually heckle me. And this is like, there is, and I know that sounds a little bit made up, but there was an article in the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Heckling the John Stewart of Egypt. And I would like you to look it up. And there was like a reporter who followed me in one of my shows in New York. And he saw it firsthand.
And how do you know they were shills?
So I got a tip from...
Or stooges, I guess is the right word, not
exactly
shills.
Exactly, stooges, yeah. And I got a tip from some of my fans, and I said like, and they sent me screenshots of the Facebook conversation that was happening, that how they were received orders to come and actually come and heckle me.
And how did they interrupt? What did they say?
Every time I mentioned CC, they will like boo me or heckle me and whatever. And at certain point started to...
Men or women?
Both. Older men and women. And at a certain point, they started to sing the Egyptian anthem.
Uh-huh.
And the whole point of doing that was to take a clip of me losing my cool, or take a kind of a 30 seconds video by their phone for people heckling me. And then they send it to the Egyptian state media, and they played it, and it was played the next day. It was played in Egyptian there as a proof that how I am rejected by the patriotic Egyptians abroad.
Did you lose your cool?
I actually made fun of them.
Oh yeah, you don't seem like a guy who loses his cool.
Sometimes
on
I do.
Stage.
I mean, one of them, like in London, like a woman, and they had this on camera, and as a matter of fact, it actually turned against them.
Yeah.
So it's like, so a woman's going, "You're a faggot!" She just like shouted at me. And in fact, it's like, so I stopped the show. It's like, "Excuse me, did you just call me a faggot?" And it's like, "Yes, I did." It's like, "Oh, that's so lovely of you. You actually paid 50 sterlings to call me a faggot?" It's like, "Yes." It's like, that is the most expensive faggot word I've ever heard of. And people just like laughed. And it just like, and it was like something that...
It backfired.
Backfired at them.
Well, she copped to being paid. She admitted it.
Yeah.
All right, so you're out doing the thing that we all do here, trying to get a show on the air, coming up with ideas.
Yeah.
What about, but it never occurred to you to go back to medicine?
No.
That's amazing.
It's behind me now. It's just like when at the age of 43, if you want to go back, you have to just like go back where you left off. So you have to go back 7 years in time and do stuff that I stopped doing when I was 30. So much.
You mean if you wanted to practice here?
Yeah. It's just like I have to start from all over again. It's just like I can't. It's just I'm too old for this shit.
Really?
Yeah. I'm still too old for the thing I do now in entertainment. So I go to acting classes, writing classes, improv classes, and I'm always the oldest guy in the room. So. But at least it's much more fun.
But does your ego miss national hero status?
No.
No?
No. You can't. You can't let your ego stand in the way of this. Because if you let your ego stand in the way, it will hinder you from learning. And I'm here learning everything from the beginning.
Now, it would seem to me that there would be a place for you on American television with your experience of authoritarian...
You think?
Yeah.
I don't know. Talk to those studio executives. Those assholes, they need to hire me.
But even as a correspondent, The Daily Show never reached out?
Well, I mean, Daily Show, it's already stacked. And I want to do, like, I want to have my own voice.
What's the angle?
Well, I mean, maybe bringing international... perspective to what's happening, not just in America, but in the world. A lot of, even when people talk in America, when talk about what's happening in the world, you talk about it from an American
point
perspective.
Of view. Yeah.
Maybe they need an international perspective to talk about international issues to American people.
In a comedic way.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And also there's
that's the idea that I'm pitching.
There's a huge international community as well.
Exactly.
And
so.
And have you had any bites, any interest?
Well, we are sitting in rooms having wonderful meetings.
Yeah.
And and it's summer, so half of the executives are on vacation. So this is Hollywood. This is television, and you just have to play the game.
You miss Egypt?
The Egypt I miss is not there anymore.
Mm. Do you find good restaurant here?
Oh, absolutely. I'm vegan, so this is heaven for me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Are there good Egyptian restaurants here?
A couple.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like what?
I mean, the thing is, I'm not looking at Egyptian food as much as vegan food. So.
No, I get it. But like, you know, good hummus is good hummus.
Why are you guys so focused on hummus? You can get hummus from Whole Foods.
No, I know, but like, you know, like there, I'm trying to think if I know any really good Middle Eastern food restaurants here.
Mostly we go to Lebanese. Lebanese cuisine is the best.
Yeah? Okay. All right. I'll keep it in mind.
Yes.
Congratulations on the new child.
Thank you so much.
It was good talking to you.
Yeah, his name is Adam,
uh-huh.
Which is a TSA-friendly name.
Yeah. There you go. Working the bits.
Yes.
Thanks, pal.
Thank you.
All right, that was me and Bassem Youssef. Check out the documentary Tickling Giants. And remember, LA people, Sunday, October 29th at 7 p.m., come see me and Brendan do our thing and sign your books at the Ann and Jerry Moss Theater in Santa Monica. Go to livetalksla.org to get tickets or go to the tour page of WTFpod.com. Fuck it. I'll play some guitar. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.